Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. As many as 1,500 people are expected to attend a conference called Beyond Brexit, The Future of Ireland, in Belfast Waterfront Hall this coming Saturday. It's organized by a new group called Ireland's Future Together in Europe, and one of the main issues it's examining is a border poll on a united Ireland. Joining us now from Belfast is Michael Patrick MacDonald, an American activist who's currently living in Ireland. He is the author of a number of books, including the American Book Award-winning bestseller, a memoir called All Souls, A Family Story from Southie, also Easter Rising, a memoir of roots and rebellion. I'm very pleased to welcome you back to our show, Michael.
Hey, Leonard. It's good to be back. Greetings from snowy Belfast.
Are you planning to attend the conference?
I am. I'll be there on Saturday. It's going to be really interesting, especially at this juncture where the north of Ireland is pretty much at the center of the whole Brexit situation in the UK and Theresa May's, the bane of Theresa May's existence at this point. So the conference will include a lot of people concerned about, first and foremost, rights issues in a post-Brexit North, and people who will be promoting the idea that a united Ireland would be the best way forward for all, including for the unionist population in the northern six counties, who I think are increasingly, just from putting out my feelers, that's a population that's been increasingly opening up to the benefits of being part of United Ireland rather than a post-Brexit Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland within the UK.
Most of the reporting in this country has been about reaction to Brexit in England and also in Europe, but I've seen very little about the Irish response, despite the fact that this is a really important issue, as you said, affecting both the North and the South in different ways, and leading some people to call for, once again, for unification of Ireland. I guess it would be an EU member completely, because the Republic of Ireland is a member of the EU?
Correct. And, it is interesting that you don't hear a lot about what people up here in the northern six counties are thinking and saying about Brexit. And I think it just points to the kind of historic dominance of the English narrative, to really limit it to a particular narrative, the English narrative, and also the kind of ignorance of the political class in England, as well as just people in England toward the North at all. You know, the day after Theresa May won, by a very slim margin, got into position, a very slim margin, swayed by the DUP, the Northern Irish Evangelical, very right-wing party, you know, people in England who were upset about her winning wanted to know who this DUP was. So the next day, the most commonly Googled term in England was DUP. Nobody knew anything about them because they're on the island of Ireland. And what's interesting about this is just that it just stays out of the consciousness of leaders there, and yet it's a useful place when it comes to this very conservative evangelical right-wing party tipping the vote in the favor of conservatives in Westminster.
But DUP sends people to Parliament. So they're in England. Yes. They are voting in the British Parliament the same as the people of England, of Scotland, of Wales. One of the conference's organizers, a Belfast solicitor named Neil Murphy, described the conference as the most significant constitutional event in a generation. Is it really that big?
Yeah, I think so. And one of the reasons is this is one of the things that people are always surprised about when I tell them, both in the United States as well as people, friends of mine in England, when I tell them that the six counties of Northern Ireland, not only do they not enjoy the rights of a modern that are enjoyed in a modern progressive Republic of Ireland, the 26 county state in the South, rights such as marriage equality, now more recently the huge landslide vote in favor of choice. The people of the northern six counties of Northern Ireland don't enjoy the rights that people in England and Wales and Scotland enjoy around some of those social issues. So at the core of this conference is that fact, and in addition to that, what will happen to other rights in a post-Brexit Northern Ireland? There are a lot of cases, legacy cases, that are rooted in the period called the Troubles of 1968 to 1998, the war between essentially Republican IRA and the British Army, and loyalists working with British Army. So there's a lot of legacy cases looking at rights violations during that period, looking at collusion between the British state and loyalist paramilitaries against a lot of Catholic civilians even in that war. That movement, the legacy movement, has depended a lot on European Court of Human Rights. And so what happens then when these ongoing cases are yanked from that jurisdiction? And, what assurances of human rights will exist in this place, in the northern six counties of Northern Ireland, in a post-Brexit world?
Aren't there
so
still...
That's at the core of the conference.
Can I ask you a question that follows up what you just said? Because you talked about... extremists from the Protestants, but a car bomb was exploded in Derry just the other day, and a new IRA group is said to be responsible. Is this a totally separate matter from what we're discussing?
Yeah, well, it's not. I mean, it's all related, of course. But there has been, since the Good Friday Agreement, the peace accord, agreed upon in 1998, which has been a pretty successful 20-plus year ceasefire. Since then, there hasn't been a lot of that activity. There's been a little bit of dissident activity, very dangerous, meaning dissident Republicans, people who don't agree with Sinn Féin and the IRA's move toward constitutionally working toward a United Irish Republic, people who don't agree with that and feel... They feel left out of the peace dividend is what they would often complain. People who, and a lot of that has to do with the continued unemployment and so forth in those communities, none of which would justify any of that. But there has been dissident activity over the past 20 years, and we're seeing a spike just in the last few days. So there was the car bomb in Derry, and there were quite a few car hijackings in the past few days. Car hijackings, people hijacking cars in order to then use them for nefarious causes such as car bombs and so forth. So hijacking cars with people in them. So this is really unusual, and this is a huge uptick in the past few days. Now, that's Republican dissident activity, but it's completely, that would be completely separate from the group that we know as the IRA, the Provisional IRA, the Irish Republican Army that fought the British Army and loyalist paramilitaries throughout those 30 years. So this would be people who may or may not have been part of that armed effort, and some of them might even be too young to have been part of it. but who are forming up a new group that's complete. That's why they would call themselves a new IRA. So they're trying to claim the term, the name, the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, and to discredit the provisional IRA that went in the direction of peace and that was actually at the forefront of the peace process in the 90s.
Getting back to the conference.
Go ahead. There's a lot of threats that are rising recently, and they're just, a lot of those dissident groups, they're small and, of course, dangerous and need to be taken really seriously. And they're also, it's important to know, historically, extremely infiltrated by the British state. So that's always been the case there as well. I don't understand how anyone can justify taking that kind of action when, in actuality, a united Ireland is as close a reality as I've ever imagined. I mean, closer reality than I've ever imagined in my lifetime. I mean, the united Ireland is really just around the corner as a result of Brexit, ironically.
Neil Murphy.
Peacefully achieved, of course.
Neil Murphy, one of the organizers of the conference, said on Thursday that it was increasingly apparent that a new relationship between Ireland and Britain is now unavoidable. But didn't the organizers receive a lot of flack for not inviting unionist politicians to participate in the union in the conference? Why didn't they?
They did. So it's actually. It is including everyone from Sinn Féin, who would identify as the historically Republican Party that was once, affiliated with the IRA, to SCLP, which was the nonviolent civil rights nationalist Irish political party, as well as some southern parties like Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. So these are people who have really disparate views on a lot of issues, social and economically. But who are united in being opposed to a hard border, and so they're not including people who, meaning the unionist parties, the Democratic Unionist Party, who have
the DUP.
Been staunchly pro hard border, and are the reason that Theresa May has not been able to get away with the idea of an Irish backstop, meaning a border in the Irish Sea as opposed to one in the island of Ireland. So their argument would be, from what I've gathered, is that why would they invite a party who is entirely these days about the opposite effect and who has the British government by the neck at this point, that has a lot of control over Theresa May. So they also feel like the dominant narrative has been coming from that unionist voice that is giving the false impression that the northern six counties are in favor of Brexit and are in favor of leaving the European Union, when in fact the northern six counties, if you just look at the northern six counties in the Brexit vote, a great majority voted to remain part of Europe. And the interesting thing about that, if a great majority of people in the northern six counties of Ireland voted to remain part of Europe, that means that not only did most of the nationalist Republican Irish identified population, i.e. Catholics, vote to remain in Europe, but also means a lot of Protestant, Unionist, Loyalist, British identified people voted to remain in Europe. So that's really interesting, and that's one of the first, I mean, it's probably one of the biggest majority votes we've seen in the North is the vote to remain in Europe. So the Democratic Unionist Party has given this false narrative that Northern Ireland is on board with this Brexit thing, when in fact it's not, like Scotland is not.
Now, there's a religious component here, because many of these people, the pro-Brexit DUP-type politicians, are also evangelicals. To some degree, it sounds like what's happening in the United States in an odd way.
It's very, very similar. It really is very similar, and it's... And, it's also similar in that, the DUP gets votes. The DUP would be socially and economically conservative. And so they would often not be working in the interest of working class Protestant people, which there are quite a few. They're not working in their interest, but yet they get votes across the board, meaning wealthier Protestants, middle class, as well as a lot of working class Protestants who would be voting against their economic interests. So not to say that they only get that popular. And the leadership of the DUP would be, you know, people who come from, I would say, probably from middle class and upper middle class backgrounds. So that's an interesting parallel, too. And I always think that it's a mistake to blame, you know, whether in the U.S. or here, to blame these extreme right-wing votes on working class populations voting against their interests, because it actually includes a much larger group of very wealthy, for example, in the U.S., wealthy white people voted for Trump as well as working class whites. So there are a lot of parallels. There's a lot of religious interests at play, at least on the Protestant Unionist Loyalist side of things. I know that, you know, so historically we think of this as Catholic and Protestant, and on the side that we think of as Catholic, really people at this point are culturally Catholic, but not really necessarily, you know, basing their laws on the Bible or what the priests have said.
As we saw with the abortion vote.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that vote, if that vote were taken up here in the northern six counties of Northern Ireland, I think that the vote for choice would also win. But that vote is not allowed, nor is the vote for marriage equality allowed, because this right-wing evangelical, that's the key word, evangelical political party, the Democratic Unionist Party, they won't even allow the vote in the first place. It's a kind of complicated thing here that was built into the Good Friday Agreement, unfortunately, that allows them to kind of veto even an option at a vote. It's this whole consent clause that they have, but they won't even allow it to come up at all. Whereas, and the other interesting thing happening here is that young people, so young Protestants who aren't necessarily religious, are not of the same mind as these older evangelical right-wing parties. A lot of them might be LGBT people themselves, or they might be LGBT friendly, or they're, of course, they're for a lot of younger Protestants would be for women's rights and the right to choose. So they're not necessarily being represented. Unfortunately, a lot of that population will move to a more, you know, progressive part of the world, meaning Europe, and now they won't be able to. So that could shift things up here as well.
My guest,
these are people that would like run away from their evangelical parents. You know what I mean?
My guest on London Lopate at Large today is Michael Patrick McDonald. Was speaking to him from Belfast. Are most of the unionist politicians who are members of British Parliament DUP, or is there a range?
There's also the UUP, which would be considered the more moderate of the two unionist parties. But I'd put that moderate in quote, you know, in quotations. I think that they are definitely not, you know, the DUP. I think a lot of Americans might remember Ian Paisley, mm-hmm. Who was an extremely bigoted evangelical minister who was one of the founders of the DUP. So it's the more outrageous of the unionist political parties, but it's the one that gets the most votes on that side of the binary, and therefore they're the party in power. And they have a slight majority over Irish nationalist Republicans.
How did the Northern Irish members of the British Parliament vote on Theresa May's plan, the one that was voted down, and then the recent no-confidence vote?
Well, I believe I didn't look at individually. The unionist politicians overwhelmingly, I would guess. I know as a bloc, the DUP definitely voted against the Irish backstop, which was part of the plan that she was proposing. That's part of her agreement. So the Irish
let's explain. The backstop is the mechanism that will guarantee an open border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in the event that the UK leaves the EU without making a deal.
Right. And that therefore the border, the kind of customs border and otherwise border, would essentially be in the Irish Sea between the island of Ireland and the rest of the UK, you know, England, Scotland, Wales. So that is the last thing that unionists want, because they know that that really is essentially a united Ireland. They shouldn't be thinking that way, but I think it would lead to that probably, but there's really no other way to guarantee not having a hard border return to the island of Ireland without going for the backstop in the Irish Sea. And so there was an agreement between the UK and the EU post-Brexit, post the vote, there was an agreement that there would not be a return to a hard border in Ireland, on the island of Ireland. So in order to keep that promise, there's no choice but to have the backstop, to have the border happen in the Irish Sea. The DUP is completely opposed to that idea. Yesterday, the Polish Prime Minister proposed. I think it's a Polish member parliament in the European Parliament.
Yes.
Proposed a 5-year backstop as a kind of middle ground proposal, but that's been flatly rejected by everyone. The DUP wouldn't go for that, but also the Republic of Ireland won't go for that either, because they feel that that would also result in chaos 5 years from now.
Jacek Czaputowicz, who is the Poland's foreign minister, actually. It caused a big stir in the EU, and a lot of people were upset. They felt that it was a way of disrupting the procedures.
So on the no confidence part, so you mean Jeremy Corbyn's calling for a no confidence vote on Theresa May?
Yes. She won the no confidence vote despite the fact that they've been showing no confidence in her.
Well, but the DUP, what's interesting about the Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland, they, on one hand, they flatly rejected Theresa May's proposal, which included the Irish backstop and no hard border, but they also would never go for, they would never vote with Labour anyway, but they, probably on anything, but they definitely are continuing to have confidence in Theresa May as prime minister, because she's all they've got, really, for their future. I mean, a united Ireland is pretty inevitable at this point. But the other thing is that this really kind of minority party, strangely, it's similar with the Electoral College. So it's this kind of trickery that exists within a supposedly democratic society that has led to a kind of minority stranglehold on the greater populations. And that's what's happening with the DUP, the amount of DUP, the amount of power the DUP has, does not compare to its electoral votes at all. Or popular votes, I should say.
In thinking about this, we, as you said earlier, we tend to think of this as a Protestant versus Catholic or Catholic versus Protestant issue. But how many Catholics, what percentage of the population of Northern Ireland is Catholic, and how large is the Protestant population in the South, in the Republic of Ireland?
So in the Republic of Ireland, in the 26 counties of the Republic of Ireland, the Protestant population would be pretty small, and essentially after the reason partition happened, separating and creating this statelet called Northern Ireland, was because a large concentration of Protestants who were loyal to the British Crown lived in a particular part of Ireland, the northeast of Ireland, and they were threatening bloodbath they were threatening bloodbath with any kind of independent United Ireland. So as a kind of pretense at compromise, the British state created a gerrymandered state, carving out six counties that would maintain a Protestant loyal to the crown population, and called it Northern Ireland. And of course, the interesting thing is always to point out that Donegal, the county Donegal, was not included in that mapping. It was not included in this created statelet, because if you included Donegal, which is north of Northern Ireland, it's part of the south, but it's actually geographically north of what we call Northern Ireland. But if they had included that, they would not have maintained a Protestant unionist loyal to the crown majority. So it's a gerrymandered state to begin with. And the rest of Ireland just didn't have those kinds of numbers or those kinds of threats at bloodshed should there be a united Ireland. The small Protestant minority in the south in the 26 counties basically lived as they did before. And in the north, what happened when partition happened in the 20s, in the north, the Protestant unionist loyal to the crown majority created essentially what I always refer to as a Jim Crow state, where all matters were administered by the Protestant unionist loyal to the crown majority, and the people who benefited from that was that population, the British-identified Protestant unionist loyalists of Northern Ireland, and the Catholic, Irish-identified Catholic nationalist minority in those northern six counties basically had no access to jobs, housing, equal education, or the right to vote. The right to vote was even denied that population because the right to vote was based on ownership of property, basically whether you're a ratepayer, which means you're paying housing taxes, which only property owners own, have, and Catholics did not own property. They were the historically left out population, historically poor population. So it maintained that voting would always guarantee that unionist loyalist, loyal to the crown, British-identified dominance. And not only did not only was voting not equal, but the more people you employed in your business, the more votes you had. So it was an apartheid state. It was a gerrymandered state. It was a Jim Crow situation where Catholics were definitely second-class citizens. Again, I don't like to refer to this as any kind of religious conflict because it wasn't about that. The Catholics were just the Irish-identified population in this history, in this kind of colonial history. So as a result, in the beginning of the creation of the statelet of Northern Ireland, it was about 2/3 to 1/3 in terms of population. So a 2/3 Protestant majority. These days, it's about 50-50. So the Catholic population has caught up. And not only that, but as I said before, the Protestant population, as I've seen, and even just talking to some people, talking to, you know, Protestant historically unionist taxi drivers and so forth, are much more open to and not afraid of the notion of a united Ireland. Some of them because they recognize the benefits that they received in this part of Europe as a result of being part of the European Union. You know, the European Union was happy, you know, that the lessening of the diminishing of the border between Northern Ireland and the South began before the Good Friday Agreement. It really began with the creation of the EU and the fact that there really wasn't a need for the hard check. So there was no excuse for the continuation of a hard border after the creation of the EU. Of course, the UK and the Democratic Union, you know, the Unionists and Loyalists of the North maintained that hard and military border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland because they claimed that they were under terrorist threat and all that.
And you've said,
of course, they were.
You've said that people who can be described as evangelical loyalists to the British Crown want more borders, would probably even go for a wall. I'm not sure a wall would be possible under the circumstances, but, you know, it's a problem between the United States and
really
Mexico
similar,
as well.
Yeah.
But is immigration one of the main issues here? Because the EU, of course, there's open immigration, and in one of the many of the supporters of Brexit in England were concerned about all of those people from Eastern Europe who are coming into their country.
Right, and I think that it's interesting that this isn't discussed right now in some of these conversations about the border, because I think that ultimately that's going to result in a hard border more than historic antagonisms between the Unionists of the North and the rest of the island. I think that the fact that that the Republic of Ireland in the South has more open immigration policies and that people could easily move to the northern six counties and therefore end up in the United Kingdom and claim their benefits and so forth that people are afraid of them claiming. Benefits, which, by the way, are completely, this is one thing I'm learning a lot being up here in the northern six counties, is that, a lot of the kind of benefits of the welfare state, probably some of the best aspects of being part of Britain, are all being completely diminished, including the NHS. Austerity is like full speed ahead, or ongoing, we should say, because it's been over a few years. But all those benefits that people claim that, foreigners are going to be using, I mean, those are kind of, they're increasingly non-existent. But this fear is real nonetheless, and fear of people taking their jobs and so forth. But it's interesting that this hasn't come up in the conversation. I think that Brexiteers, in the aftermath of the vote and the image, the kind of racist image that the vote, vote has, I think they've kind of intentionally moved away from any conversations around foreigners and immigrants and so forth. Although Nigel Farage, stays on that front, but Tories and conservatives who want to remain, like, appear to be respectable human beings are really intentionally moving away from that conversation. But I think you're right. I think that that's at the core of a lot of fears, and that would be the reason ultimately for a hard border on the island of Ireland. And it would be, and there are people who would not mind a wall. So the parallels are just incredible, actually, with home in the U.S.
Michael Patrick McDonald is our guest today. We are talking about relations between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland in the context of Brexit and a conference called Beyond Brexit, the Future of Ireland, that's coming up this Saturday in Belfast, with an American who is currently living in Ireland, Michael Patrick McDonald, the author of a number of best-selling books, especially All Souls, A Family Story from Southie. And I was surprised that the conference, Michael, is in Belfast. It's the capital of Northern Ireland. I would have assumed that with this topic, it would have been in Dublin.
Yeah, but see, that's, of course, the Dublin government is a Fine Gael government, and that would be the more conservative of the political parties in the South. Although Fine Gael, and Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach of the 26-county Republic of Ireland, have kind of held a line on, for example, the backstop. They just won't budge, thankfully, won't budge on the notion of a return to a hard border on the island of Ireland. Hopefully they'll stick to that. But they wouldn't be the kind of in the leadership. They would never want to appear to be promoting a united Ireland. So this conference really, that part of the conversation is going to be a big part of what happens at the conference.
But Sinn Féin's vice president, Michelle O'Neill, has talked about this as being a way of finally uniting Ireland. So Sinn Féin, which would be considered a more left part of the Irish government, is supporting a united Ireland, while the more conservative government, the Republic of Ireland, is not?
Right. They're not. It's not that they're not. They're just not putting that. They're not talking about that. I'm sure a lot of people in Fine Gael and even maybe Leo Varadkar would be in favor of United Ireland, but they'd be a party that would be more afraid of of rocking the boat with its relationship with Britain. With the mention of Michelle O'Neill. So Michelle O'Neill is the vice president of Sinn Féin. The current president of Sinn Féin is Mary Lou McDonald. That's been a really interesting move recently, led by two women. It also puts a lot of the social issues at the forefront of the Sinn Féin agenda. Social issues, such as choice and marriage equality. Irish language rights are really important to them as well. And Michelle O'Neill tweeted a really interesting comment yesterday, so I just want to read that because you have to keep in mind that Sinn Féin historically would be the Republican Party. They would be the Irish Republican Party, of course, nothing to do with our U.S. Republicans, of course, more of a left Republican concept, and they would be the political wing, essentially the political wing of the Irish Republican Army. So this would be the political party that did not apologize, they apologized for a lot of the horrific things that happened in that history, but they don't apologize for being Republicans. And so they would be considered hardline on their Republicanism, meaning therefore a united Irish Republic and, you know, away from monarchy and birthright inequalities and all symbols of such and so forth. So her quote on Twitter yesterday, our task, I mean, this kind of blew my mind because this is a real openness and a reaching out like I've never seen. Our task as United Irelanders is to face outwards and listen to those who don't want a united Ireland, to convince all of the merits of a new future together. And therefore, we need to listen to and understand unionist fears, because they too must belong, not as a minority, and she means not as a minority within the island of Ireland, which they would be, but as equals. So that's a real expression of reaching out that you won't get on the other side. And some people would criticize Sinn Féin and criticize Michelle O'Neill probably for going that far and reaching too far across the aisle. And, of course, the people on the other side of the aisle are just going to bite your hand off and screw you. But they know what they're doing, Sinn Féin. And I think that they will be at the forefront of this conference that happens on Saturday. They are including, of course, all other parties who are not in favor of Brexit. That would mean the DUP is not coming, but they are probably taking the lead on this conference.
Now, Seamus,
comment is reflective of the kind of vibe of this conference this coming Saturday. It will be outward looking, and it will seek to be inclusive to a population that historically has feared being a minority in a majority Irish-identified Catholic Ireland.
Well, we're talking about the big picture, but on a very basic level, Seamus Lahaney, who's from the Freight Transport Association, points out that there are around 20,000 lorry drivers, truck drivers, in Northern Ireland, with around 13,000 of those trucks crossing the border each day. And the lack of available permits could potentially be disastrous for Northern Ireland. We've seen something similar with other countries that are not parts of the EU that trade with the EU, Turkey, Switzerland, for example. So he said only 60 truck drivers from Northern Ireland will be able to cross the border in the event of a no deal. And that would have not only be disastrous for the trucking industry, but would be disastrous for many other businesses, because suddenly things wouldn't be crossing the borders.
Right, and we're seeing some businesses in the UK, mainland England, jumping ship and moving elsewhere because of especially the shipping stuff. I mean, getting from even from the Republic of Ireland, not even going across the border, but getting from the Republic of Ireland, from Dublin, over to the European Union. Would mean you have to go around, around Wales in England to get to France. And so it's a much longer journey. Certain things won't do well with the amount of time that journey will take, certain foods and so forth. So that'll have a huge impact there, but also just in terms of, like you're saying, the flow across between north and south. I mean, it's an island. It's a really small island. And it's just absurd that this continues to this day. It's really the last frontier of the empire, too. And it's interesting. There was an interesting article in the New York Times this week, an op-ed piece by an Indian writer looking at how this border question is kind of bringing it all back home to roost, you know, and this is ultimately will be the demise of this writer claimed, the demise of all British imperial pretense, that the ruling class of the United Kingdom, people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, the really elite Conservative Party people, private boys club people, they all hold on to those imperial pretensions still, but it's all been kind of blown to smithereens at this point, I think, as a result of Brexit, an inadvertent result of a very conservative vote.
There are fears that more smuggling will take place as the UK exits the EU, and also concerns that duty-free shopping may hit Ireland's ability to collect taxes. Brexit might force the Republic of Ireland and the UK to change work rules between them. So,
right,
there are all these things that have to be worked out if no Brexit deal is finally arrived at.
Right, and these are things that would have needed a lot of time, but people are stuck in this deadline. One of the conversations happening now also is the notion of an extension of Article 50, which is about the implementation time to allow Brexit to happen, to extend the deadline from March 29th, which is just around the corner. But Conservatives will have none of that, and people who feel beholden to the population that voted to leave will just not have. They won't entertain the question of extending the deadline. They also won't entertain the question of doing another vote at what's being referred to as a people's vote. A lot of people believe that if you took the vote again in the United Kingdom, that the Remainers would win because people didn't anticipate the amount of chaos that this is proving to bring.
On the other hand, aides said that Theresa May was concerned over the possibility of bad feeling or rancor and harm to trust in democracy if the majority who voted to leave in 2016 felt the voice was being ignored.
Right. And she might be right about that. You know, it's kind of like the question of impeachment in the U.S. I mean, people, a lot of us want this person, Trump to go away. And but a lot of people predict a lot of chaos if such a thing were to happen. It's a very similar argument there. The chaos would be the result of a pretty substantial portion of the population that is really riled up and can be really dangerous. But I think it's in both places. It's a result of the fact that discourse has completely changed. Maybe in a big way as a result of social media and Twitter and a lot, and things going to a binary kind of good and evil, and I'm right and you're wrong. I don't know. So, and there's been a lot of manipulation. Of course, it was a lot of manipulation by Russia and the United Kingdom as well. And there's a lot of dark money that went into the DUP. The DUP's worked toward supporting Brexit during and in the lead up to the vote. So there are just a lot of parallels, and it's not even parallel because there's something going on globally in terms of the kind of sabotage of democracy and instigation of chaos. I think it's really clear, and I think the same instigators in the U.S. are probably quite active in the U.K. And I wouldn't be surprised if they get more active in the northern six counties in terms of instigating more dissident violence, because that's weird to see dissident Republican violence in the face of a situation where there very well might be a united Ireland that could come about peacefully as a result of Brexit. It just seems weird that people would be, bringing back car bombs and things like this when something they've always dreamed of is just right around the corner, and right around the corner in a peaceful way.
Theresa May announced that she was scrapping a £65 fee for EU nationals wanting to remain in the UK after Brexit. So were people who from the Republic of Ireland who worked in the north, forced to pay £65 every year?
Just to work?
Yeah, I
just came across that myself, and I was surprised. I thought that, I wasn't sure if she meant that if that's something that was part of the Brexit plan or if that's something that's already there. It must be something that's already there, but
she's going to scrap
aware
it.
Of. Yeah, but that's not, I mean, that's not even something that anybody's organized around. You know, nobody's really fired up about the £65 fee. One of the things that's going to be discussed at the conference for the Future of Ireland on Saturday is the rights of Irish citizens in the northern six counties, and that includes the population that was born and raised here, who would be Irish identified, the Catholic population, nationalist or Republican, who have always had Irish passports as part of their commitment to being Irish on the island of Ireland. And so a lot of them they have right to British and Irish passports. Of course, that didn't mean a whole lot within the Europe, because ultimately you have a European passport. But now that's coming to mean something, whether or not you're going to have a British passport or an Irish passport or both. And I have Irish citizenship.
Is that why the conference is also being called the Civic Nationalism Conference? Although the conference's organizers have moved away from the term civic nationalism because nationalism has become a kind of a negative word these days. But civic nationalism, what does that mean?
I think they're emphasizing the civic aspect. In other words, that this isn't about, this is the opposite of being about the return to armed struggle. You know, that this is about civic participation and constitutional approaches toward a nation, a united Ireland. Nationalism here on the island of Ireland has always been, it's a different kind of perspective because it's really about national sovereignty in the face of a history of having been colonized by a great power, the British Empire. So it's not nationalism in the sense that we think of it, but you know, globally now, I mean, you can't help but think of nationalism in kind of fascist terms. So I think people would want to move away from that word, but the civic aspect was what they were is why they even came up with the term at all, I believe. I don't know for sure, but I think that they were just making sure that people know that this is that this has nothing to do with any questions of returning to violence ever, and that this is a civic process and a constitutional process. But one of the issues that they're bringing up is what will be the rights of Irish citizens in Northern Ireland post-Brexit. So that would even apply to me. So I have dual citizenship between the U.S. and Ireland. My citizenship would only be full in the 26 county south post-Brexit, whereas up to now, I would have enjoyed the same rights in the northern six counties, mostly as a lot of the rights that were assured were a result of the Good Friday Agreement as well. And people in the northern six counties were pretty much full. You know, they're all EU citizens, but they're also a lot of Protestants in the north. After the Brexit vote, a lot of Protestants in the north that were afraid of being pulled out of Europe were applying for Irish passports. You know, people in the United Kingdom, people in England with like one Irish grandmother or grandfather were applying for Irish passports in order to remain European citizens. And nothing has been done to nothing. There's been no clarity on what rights will be preserved by Irish citizens living in Northern Ireland or people who identify as Irish within Northern Ireland.
Michael,
and that would mess with the whole Good Friday Agreement.
We have very little time left, and I just wanted to address one other thing. I was wondering what your thoughts were about the announcement by Facebook that it's going to add 1,000 new roles in the Republic of Ireland this year across 60 teams, including engineering, safety, legal, policy, marketing, and sales, an expansion that will bring to 5,000 the number of people employed by by Facebook in Ireland at its sites in Dublin, Meath, and Cork. Now, why is Facebook, does it have such a huge presence in Ireland?
It has a huge presence in Dublin, for the most part, in terms of, you know, and also Google. A lot of the big tech companies, of course, got came in with tax breaks and so forth.
So this is all about taxes?
Yeah, I think it for the most part, a lot of them really, and you know, pretty much are going tax-free. And then who knows what happens, you know, down the road? Like, what commitment do they really have in the country long-term? But what are the things that we've seen with the kind of upsurge in tech companies in Dublin is a huge kind of gulf between very prosperous, educated, technologically educated and employed populations in Dublin and then the rest of the island. And, of course, they move into Cork as well. Meath would be an extension of Dublin anyway. So there's this whole, historically, you know, that whole area would be much more prosperous than the rest of the island in the south, at least. And they and Google has exacerbated that. Twitter, Facebook, their presence in Dublin has really caused this huge divide, and a divide that's resulting in political results that we're seeing in the U.S. So you're seeing a population more further west, more rural, that wouldn't be having the same lifestyle or conversations that people are having in urban, Googleized Dublin, and therefore you there's a lot of opportunity for right wing populists to seize upon, you know, the begrudgery of less prosperous places, if that makes sense. So you see a lot. It's interesting that, I mean, that divide in the huge United States, of course, is between the coasts and the rest of the, you know, the middle of the country. But it's interesting to see that such a divide is possible on such a small island of ultimately about 6 million people. So,
are you living in the north or the south?
What's that?
Are you living in the north or the south?
I'm living in the north. I'm living in Belfast. I'm here on a Fulbright, teaching at Queen's University, and also doing community work with people who have survived a lot of trauma throughout the Troubles, similarly to what I do back home, and then connecting them to people back in Boston who are survivors of homicide victims and the drug trade there, but basically with a writing and storytelling curriculum that I've brought over here to do in economically disadvantaged communities that are actually both Catholic and Protestant.
I'll be looking for reports on this conference that's coming up this Saturday called Beyond Brexit, The Future of Ireland in Belfast. And my great thanks to Michael Patrick MacDonald for talking to us about the impact of Brexit on both the north and south of Ireland. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you. I'm a little bit homesick, so it was great to get the lifeline to New York today. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Michael Patrick MacDonald, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Blended Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to the Blended Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.